You've all heard the word pratyahara. What does pratyahara mean? Interiorization of the mind. I was in San Francisco area the other day, and I was in somebody's home, and he turned on the TV, and I saw epitomized before me the exact opposite of pratyahara. Where in the practice of yoga, we try to draw the mind inward. There they were all just really relating to the audience and to one another with the thrill of this new kind of soap and the excitement of that quiz program and the delight of having won and answered a question right and won some kind of prize and so on. It's a very good lesson sometimes to see those people who manifest just the opposite of what it is that we're trying to develop. Because what we are is somewhere within that scale between two poles. If we were completely, I'm using a simile, you could always, there's no simile, it's perfect. Because of course, when we're really talking about spiritual development, we're canceling out the poles, aren't we? But I'm talking of two opposite lines of development here. And when you know that this is where you're supposed to be, and see very clearly this is where you're not supposed to be, then you may know that somewhere along the line you'll probably find yourself in the middle. And the question is, which direction are you moving in? If you move in the wrong direction, it will be more and more toward what the world tells you is right and proper for all. In the path, I've mentioned that the irreconcilable difference between the worldly person and the devotee is that the worldly person lives for himself and what he can get out of everything. And everything he does, he thinks in terms of what's in it for me. And the devotee thinks always first, what does God want? What will please God? But there are many ways of expressing this same teaching, and this is another one, that the worldly person, everything that he does is designed to take him outside himself and interest him in that which is not himself. And the devotee, everything that he does is a reminder, everything that he sees is a reminder of what he has and what he is inside. This kind of consciousness is a very worthwhile thing for devotees to develop. Because you see, we're trained in another way, aren't we? We've been brought up in a world that tells us that everything that you want must be based on desire. Everything that you want to develop must be a reaching out for something that you don't have right now. And so, just as that song that we sang at the beginning, Door of My Heart, in the original Bengali, there's one stanza that Master didn't translate. And that stanza, somewhere within it, one couplet, I guess it was, it uses the expression somewhere within it. I don't know the words well of the whole line because Master didn't use it and therefore I didn't bother to learn it. But it says, Ami Bikiri, I am a beggar. And Master wouldn't translate that because he would never accept that we should approach God in the consciousness of begging for anything. He said in a talk of his that you may have all heard that you should not say, he doesn't like to hear people say, when will I have God? Even that, you should not be reaching out for God in the sense of thinking that you don't have him. Say, I have him right now. We must have that consciousness that we are complete even while we have much yet to develop, because all that we really have to develop is what we are. When you sit in meditation, so often the tendency is to think in terms of what's wrong with your life, how far you are from God, what you haven't developed, why doesn't God come to you? It would be far better, really, to be able to sit in yourself and say, I am that I am. Simply to feel as if this sense of ego had been cancelled out. Simply to feel that you are already perfect in Him. This is not a thought that will diminish your devotion. In fact, it's strange, but your feeling of love grows the more you can cancel out that thought of separateness. Again, how do you develop that kind of consciousness? Well, just as you can see the opposite examples and learn from them, so look for those people in this world who have more of that kind of dispassion that you want. One of the temptations on the path of Raja Yoga is the temptation to become too involved in the self and not, therefore, compassionate enough to other people. But it should be an inwardness that feeds the fires of compassion. You know the difference between sympathy and compassion? Sympathy is something you might feel for somebody in a movie, but compassion is when you can get out there and do something for that person. You can't do that for anybody in a movie or through a window or something. It's somebody that you can reach out and actually help. Compassion is practical sympathy. And when you feel that kind of inwardness that is in touch with the fires of love, in touch with that flow of real compassion, then automatically there's a reaching out. So just as it's good sometimes to see examples of those states of consciousness that you want to avoid, so also it's not only good but very necessary to mix with people who have that inwardness but with compassion, not that kind of cold aloofness that comes sometimes. It's sort of one of the side traps on the spiritual journey. Don't allow yourself to get trapped in that coldness, but rather always let it, in that sense of canceling yourself out, as I'm putting it now, in that sense of being complete within yourself, realize that a part of that completeness are all your brothers and sisters in the world. But, for example, and you don't have to be with a person in order to get the full benefit of satsang, meditate on the eyes of Master, for example, and see in those eyes, on the one hand, that very withdrawn look that was never touched by anything. On the other hand, that very deep love that came from being so much at the core of love that it was already one with anything. You see, the difference again between worldly love and divine love is that a worldly love is reaching out, but divine love is there already. Divine love doesn't have to reach out and reassure itself. It already is one with everyone. It has that love, whether it expresses itself outwardly or not. It has that love, no matter how people treat it. It's strange, but the more you develop of divine love, the more usually it happens that you attract also the enmity of those who aren't ready for that kind of love. They crucify themselves on that, because what happens is that they strike out in anger against this, which is a reminder of what they should be and they don't intend to be, they won't be. Then, because they've been in that anger, they feel hurt, and they associate that hurt with the person that they're angry with. They get more angry and more angry, and finally they try to kill him or crucify him or whatever. This happens in the lives of saints, and it's just a part of the divine play. And yet what they are doing is crucifying themselves, because they're building in themselves more and more of that hatred, more and more of that anger, and finally they just wither up and die. It is, however, one of the things that happen when that energy is strong. And on the other hand, those who are in tune with that kind of flow, they get more and more, that you are like a sort of divine gardener watering the plants of thirsty souls. And without even trying, it happens. How to do that? By being more with those who have that state of consciousness. You can't really imagine yourself into it. I've seen many people try to get into it, and because they haven't understood it from within, they get into what I was talking about, for instance, that tendency to be cold or withdrawn in a neutral or negative way, rather than withdrawn into this fountainhead of energy, so that they can pour that energy out again to all. Everything that you do, let it remind you of what you are, who you are inside. You are a child of the infinite. Never sell yourself short. Never allow yourself to think that you are a limited human being with faults. Yes, you've got faults to work with. Those are just weeds in your garden. They aren't you. Yes, you don't have samadhi and you want it. But that's just a little veil over your mind. You haven't yet seen who you really are. You are a child of God. And that you aren't anything else. That's all that you are. Everything else is a dream. This world seems so real. I think I told you recently about the time that I was dreaming and I dreamed that I was flying in the air. And I thought, oh, people don't do this. What's the matter? What's happened? I thought, maybe I'm dreaming. This thought came somewhat down the line. First, I was just trying to analyze how it was that I should be flying. And then I realized that it must be because I was dreaming. So I tried to analyze it very logically to decide whether I was dreaming or whether I was awake. And finally, I came to the thoroughly logical conclusion that I was awake. I was just doing something unusual. And a moment later, I woke up and I was so surprised. So it is that this world seems so real, but it's not. You know that beautiful story of Narada when he was meditating and he finally had the darshan of God in the form of Vishnu. And Vishnu said that he would grant any boon that Narada asked. And Narada, having achieved self-realization, you see, when you get into that state, the saints all say it seems so simple. That's the problem, really, that it is simple. And everything else, we're used to making things complex. That's why we take such a long time. And so, in his sort of bemusement, he said, Lord, I'd like to understand how it is. Maybe he didn't realize that he was asking this boon, but he said, how is it that people can go such a long time in delusion? And Vishnu said, all right, Narada, come with me. And so they went for a walk, and they came to a desert, and they were walking across this desert, and they were getting very hot and very thirsty. And finally, off in the distance, they saw the smoke from a house, and there were a few houses there. It seemed like there was a little village. And Vishnu said, Narada, I'm very thirsty. Would you go to that village and get me a glass of water? And Narada said, yes, Lord, of course. So he went, and he knocked on the door of the first house he came to, and was answered by a beautiful young girl. And as soon as they met one another, it felt as if they'd known each other always. And he was accepted into the family. Forgot poor Vishnu standing out there in the desert. And he married the girl and settled down and got a job. Opened up a shop. Had 3 children over a period of 12 years. And finally, at the end of those 12 years, there was a great flood. And the flood just in a few moments washed away his business, his home, everything that he spent 12 years working to develop. And as he was trying to escape with all that was left to him, which was no possessions, nothing, just his family, his wife was walking by his side through swirling waters. He held one of each of his children in each hand, and the little infant, whom he couldn't hold also, he had perched on his shoulder. And they walked some distance, struggling to try to reach high ground, when he tripped a little bit over a pebble or a little boulder. And at that moment, his little infant slipped into the stream. And as it was swept away, he tried to grab it. And in letting go of his other 2 children to grab the infant, they too were swept away. And as he looked despairingly at his wife, he found that she too was lost her footing, and she was swept away. And he lost all heart, and he just let the current take him. Everything was gone, and he lost consciousness. And after what seemed like a long time, he came back to consciousness, and he discovered that he hadn't drowned. It seemed as if he'd been washed up onto some sort of a dry mound or something, because as he looked in all directions, he saw nothing but a vast expanse of muddy water. And he heard this voice saying, Narada? And he looked up and he saw that it wasn't muddy water, it was just the brown sand of the desert. And he looked up further and he saw it was Vishnu. And he suddenly remembered. And Vishnu looked down and said again, Narada, what happened? Half an hour ago I sent you for a glass of water and I find you sleeping in the sand. This is how this world is. It seems so real because we're so close to it. I remember sitting in a bus in San Francisco once, and my eyes were looking ahead, but I could see something from the corner of my eye. It looked like a huge thing walking very quickly across the wall of a house. And I was so surprised, and I turned around, and I saw it was a little fly on the window. But because it was so close, it seemed to be very big and moving very fast. Similarly, those things that are close to us seem big and seem to have lots of movement and seem very important. They command a lot of attention. And it's only because they're close to us. It's only because we allow them to be close to us through attachment, through personal identification, through the thought of I and mine. What we need to do is develop pratyahara. What we need to do in everything is withdraw a little bit into our mind and into ourself. This is something we practice all the time, should practice all the time, as devotees. Everything that you do, always let it remind you of what you are inside. Always let it remind you of the bliss in your own spine. The Catholics have the word recollectedness. It's a very good word. Always to remember. In fact, it's a yogic word. As Patanjali gave, his definition of enlightenment was smriti, memory. To remember what you are. This is what you've probably all experienced in one way or another on the path. That you've, I remember in my experience. I was very intellectual when I came to Master, and I worked hard because I didn't like this intellectualism. I remembered the sweetness of that I'd felt as a child, and I wanted to recapture that. So I worked very hard to develop devotion and openness on a heart level and so on. And when I remember when I first experienced that ray of divine love, my first thought was, but of course. You know, when you learn something in the world, you take out a notebook and you say, I've got to write this down. I don't want to forget any of it. You don't feel that way when you experience something that's your own self, do you? Haven't you all had that experience in one way or another? That you've touched something of the soul within yourself, and your first thought was, but of course, this is what I am. I don't have to try to remember what it's like because that's what I am. This is the natural state for the soul. It's your nature to be in samadhi. It's your nature to be in divine bliss. It's your nature to be absolutely flowing all the time in love and joy. And sometimes that joy gets so much you feel you can hardly stand it. And yet, if you just relax, it just keeps growing and growing. Think of Sister Gyanamata's words as she died. Too much joy. Too much joy. Her body couldn't take it, but she just gave up her body and then she became it. This is what you are. And if you can live in that thought, you know, the thing is that it takes courage. That's the reason people run away from it. It takes courage to hang on to it. It takes courage to leave all those things that keep you from it. It takes courage to change those directions because there is always this pull to be outward and to become like those TV personalities. Just, oh boy, the world again, and so on. But it should really be a deeply inward thing. And even when you go outward, I don't mean to go around like a zombie, even when you do enjoy the world, enjoy it with the joy of God. I remember Brother Bimalananda in SRF, we were out in the desert in retreat one time. And I remember him doing his energization exercises and he was doing the double breathing and saying, pump it in, Divine Mother, pump it in. And when you live in this consciousness, there's joy. It isn't as if you didn't enjoy things, but you enjoy it in a very different way. I would look at Master when he enjoyed. He could laugh till the tears would stream down his cheeks. And yet it was always an inward thing. It was always, there was always something that fed these fires of delight inwardly. And when you do that, they never run dry. But when you don't, they run dry all the time. By nightfall, you're exhausted with the world. And Oh, I remember reading years ago, The Sun Also Rises by Ernest Hemingway. Have you read that book? Do you remember how the people, after all their outward stimulation of bullfights and parties and all the things they did, and they'd go back to their room at night, and how alone and almost desperately depressing it was to suddenly face a reality with no stimulation. They don't know how to handle it. The world dries up for them, and they've got nothing to replace it with. You don't get any joy from the world. It's only a joy that you give to the world. And people, because they don't have joy, therefore they sort of try to get excited, and they think that in that excitement they are fulfilling something. There's no excitement. There's no joy in excitement. As it says in the Bhagavad Gita, for the peaceless person, how is happiness possible? We were visiting Marcel Vogel the other day, Seva and Jyotish and Devi and I. And his mother asked us after being with us for a few minutes, are you all members of the same family? And Devi said, no, in a way we are, but not blood family. And she said, well, you all seem so much alike. You have so much joy. And this is something that is true for all people who live in that inner consciousness, that they have joy. And our way is to try to express that joy to one another and express that joy in the world. But it must always proceed from this internalization, interiorization of the mind first. So everything that you do, even when you enjoy, let it remind you of that inner joy. And let that outer joy not only remind you, but feed those fires of joy. Be with those who have that consciousness. Don't be with people who take your mind outward. Those who inspire you truly are those, I mean in a divine way, are those who bring you more toward an impersonal consciousness, who bring you more toward this inwardness. You know, the wonderful thing is that two devotees, when they are together and have this consciousness, they can be flowing in bliss and never say a word. Isn't it so? Haven't you ever experienced that with people? That when you are with devotees, when you are, I've seen Master just walking hand in hand with Rajashi on the grounds at Mount Washington, not saying a word, but just both of them flowing with bliss. When you can have that bliss inside, when you can draw that kind of bliss from one another, when in the company of others who are dear to you, you feel that flow of bliss and your communion's on that level, and everything else said and seen outwardly and shared in an outward way is really only just sort of an echo of what you feel inside. What a blissful relationship that is. It's the most precious thing that can possibly happen between people. That kind of soul contact is something that doesn't take your mind outward. It's not based on attachment. It's something that feeds you in this very consciousness of pratyahara that we're speaking about. It reminds me of one time when we were visiting Anandamayi Ma, and Daya Ma was given quite a few private talks with Anandamayi Ma. And she said to her one time, I feel selfish taking up so much of your time when there are so many others who want to see you too. And Anandamayi Ma's answer was really marvelous. She said that that cannot be selfishness which takes you out of the self. Speaking of ego, in other words. Isn't that a wonderful answer? There's a lot of depth there. It isn't selfishness to want those things which take you out of ego. Because that's the whole thing about selfishness, is that it takes you into ego and separates you from others. But in the inspiration that you feel in the company of a saint, in the inspiration that you feel in those who feed this joy within, there is no attachment. It isn't attachment to want those things that give you your own self. It isn't attachment to want to be around those people who give you this divine joy and this divine love. Be with those people. It becomes attachment if you think that it's something outside yourself. But it's not attachment if it's something inside. In other words, it's not attachment. For example, it wasn't attachment to want to be with Master, unless one's reason for being with Master was purely that he would smile at you and pat you on the head and say you did a good job or anything like that. that's ego, that's attachment. But if it's something inward, and if what you get from being with him is this inner joy, then that's freedom. That's something that leads to freedom, and it's right. In other words, look for that kind of association which can remind you of your inner self. Everything that you do, always in the back of your mind, practice japa. Always say just Om Guru or Om Kali, Om Divine Mother, Om Christ. Always think in yourself, I am that I am. Always feel, as Master said, always remain in the self. Come down a little bit every now and then to eat or talk a little bit as necessary, then withdraw into yourself again. Seek seclusion. Seek those times as the most precious of all times when you can be alone. The worldly person doesn't ever want to be alone. The devotee knows that this is when he's least alone. I remember that period of time in the Himalayas when I was in seclusion, and it was really one of the most blissful times in my life. I didn't see anybody, I didn't speak to anybody. I meditated long hours, and then in the afternoon I would take long walks with Master and Babaji and Divine Mother. And I was, after a very short time, so full of bliss that I felt that I didn't ever want to leave that. I had to leave it because I had duties in my work and I was supposed to go out and lecture. But the pain of having to leave that state of seclusion, I knew that I could remain like this for the rest of my life and be very, very blissful. Our greatest bliss comes when we can be alone. You know, that bliss lasted quite a long time. But you know what took me down from it? Very interesting. I think I should share it with you so that you can understand something that may be useful to you. I became introduced to that phenomenon of the Bhrigu Sanghita. And it was so fascinating that I wanted to understand it more. And in the process of trying to understand it more, I found that somehow my mind was being taken outside myself. You know the Bhrigu story, don't you? It's the old document that I discovered that had the lives of people who were to live for thousands of years. And I found my name there and my own life described. And I wasn't so much fascinated just by what it said about me, although that was interesting enough in itself, but more just the fact that such a thing could exist and what it could mean for expressing the teachings to people to convince them of the greatness of this culture in ancient times. It could produce something like this. My interest was on many levels that way, but it was an outward interest, wasn't it? Had to be, because that's what happened to my mind. I found my mind starting to get outside that constant flow of bliss. And I say that because periodically here at Ananda, we find a fascination growing with some kind of phenomenon. Magic, psychic phenomena, powers, this thing and that thing. All of them are okay. They're not bad. In themselves, you've got to do something with your life, I suppose. Don't get too interested. Always remember that what it's really all about is this search within. Don't worry about whether things are up or down. There's that lovely story that Vivekananda told of a yogi that he met near Rishikesh. The yogi lived in an ashram out in the forest. And one day he had gone out for a walk, and he'd gone close to the village, I suppose, of Rishikesh. And he didn't wear any clothes. He was a Naga Sadhu, sky-clad. And when the village boys saw him, they were the way children can do. They just teased the life out of him and persecuted him and ran after him with stones and bricks and threw these things at him and sort of drove him away, sort of like an unnatural human being, because he was dressed differently from them. In fact, not dressed at all. And this yogi came back to his ashram laughing happily, just like a child. He said, "Oh, we had such a good time today. The children were throwing stones." And we were all laughing, and he didn't even stop to think that the stones were being thrown at him. Isn't that beautiful? Just no sense of self, no sense of ego, just it happened. Or that lovely thing that somebody told me the other day, that a man that he knows says that whenever he's trying to work on a project, either on his own or with a group, the first question he asks is not what do we do, what should we do, what do we want to do, what would you like to do? What is trying to happen here? Isn't that nice? I told you that the other week. Think of it in that way, that what is trying to happen? Think of everything that you do. Try to think of it impersonally, not with the self-involvement that I'm trying to do this. What is trying to happen? What energy then can I put out that will help that to happen? Be impartial. Don't have ups and downs. When things are bad, they're not really bad. Master said that conditions are always neutral. They seem good or bad according to the joyful or sad attitudes of the mind. And it's amazing how true that is, even for those things that seem the most difficult to take, that when a person can reach that point of neutrality in himself, he can see, gee, that was pretty good after all. Why would anybody go to see a tragedy in the movies or on the stage? Why? Because they come out of it and they say, I feel cleansed. I learned so much. That was a wonderful movie. It made me wiser. Why can't you do that with your life then? When things go wrong, just say, oh, that's wonderful. I'm learning so much. Or our Ananda expression, it's a learning experience. Always just be impartial in yourself and just say that whether it's good or bad is indifferent to me. It is, and I am. And I would relate to it in the now, just without any judgment at all. Without ups and downs, without that tendency to be drawn out of yourself and identified with anything, always see everything as just a reflection of this self within. Everything that you do, always go back and remember the self. Don't get drawn too much. This I've said it, and I say it very seriously because I know that that is the tendency of people in general. I've seen it in myself, this tendency to think, oh, how fascinating, and get fascinated by something that is spiritual, and yet, because it takes you out of yourself, it isn't. Like the UFO thing. It's all very interesting, and it's very fine if these people from other planets tell us that we should love one another and so on. Good, nothing. But to say, oh, they say such deep truths, they say we should love each other. Isn't that something you know already? You don't need somebody from Mars to tell you. Don't get too fascinated by things outside. Is it a wonderful book to read is The Imitation of Christ by Thomas A. Kempis. And he used to, when he was alive, if people would call him out, guests would come to see him, for example, he would talk to them for a while, and then he'd say, well, excuse me, but I have a guest waiting for me in my cell. And he didn't explain that that guest was Christ. But this was his excuse to leave them and go back to where he was, where he belonged. The statement that he made in his book, The Imitation of Christ, one was that, what will you see anywhere in the world but the same sky and the same earth? If you're going only to see things, then it's not the answer. If you're going to experience, it may be all right, but don't feel that you need anything except your own self. Go within and live within, and then you can go through the world and be completely free. Then, in fact, the traveling of a sannyasi is a good thing, because it always helps to emphasize that you don't belong anywhere, that wherever you are, you belong, because you're carrying your temple with you. This is your ashram, this body, and wherever you are, then, to learn to be at home is very good. The rule, the classic rule of sannyasis is not to stay more than 3 days in a place, just so that they won't get to feeling that I belong here, because you only belong where you are. The more you can live in that state, then, of pratyahara, the more you can live in that state, just the opposite of the TV thing, just live within and always feel that your life is in your spine, the more you can relate in that way to one another, the more you can remain happy together in silence, the more you can seek the company of those to whom you don't need to speak a great deal in order to share, because what you know is the vibrational exchange between you. The more you can develop that kind of love and that kind of friendship, and those of you who are married, if you can develop that kind of love for one another, where your communion is more of the mind, where you feel that because the vibrations are there, you're experiencing this interchange of vibration, that's quite enough. The more you have of that, the less you will have of the upsets that come so easily into human relations, and perhaps even especially into marriage. To make the basis of your relationship the outer first and hope that somehow you'll stumble onto the inner is perhaps to drive the inner out of the picture altogether. It would be well to base your relationship together on self-control. Base it on this inward sharing and let everything outward, all outward manifestations of love and friendship and camaraderie and whatever, let all of those be only a kind of little reflection, a little outward affirmation, a little outward expression of something that's much more real inside. Then you'll find that the sweetness of all things outward comes into the picture. Beautiful music, beautiful friendships, beautiful times, beautiful scenery. Everything becomes beautiful when we have that inner beauty. All things become dry when we give up that consciousness and seek it outside ourselves.